There we go. So, my friend Jim Wilson has been a peerless investigator into many arenas of philosophical and spiritual inquiry. And one of the longest, one of the topical areas that he has longest or spent more time on than many others is his dear friend Plotinus. Probably he was a student in a previous birth, and now he is here to give us the insight of his continuing meditation. Of course, most of you know Jim as manager of the store, one of the three founders of the store, without whom the store would not exist, and without whom it would not continue to exist. So I hope you will join me. There are many plaudits I could remind you of, but most... He has many achievements to his credit, but it would only embarrass him if I ran through the list. So why don't you just embarrass him by giving a huge hand of applause.
Thank you for coming tonight. I think this is really auspicious for 2017. And we need all the auspicious energy we can muster. What I'd like to do is begin with a few minutes of silent contemplation. Set the tone. So, Mimi.
Hi. Oh, and George is coming. It has to park.
Okay, so I need another. I need another chair.
We're two chairs right here.
In the back.
Okay.
Is that too far?
Oh no.
No. Okay.
Well, I like to be right in front.
All right.
But.
Well, I don't know where you are.
There's somebody coming to that chair.
She made an executive decision.
Oh, I didn't see.
You saving
for me?
Yeah. No.
Oh.
Here you go.
I even asked Jim if he'd seen you.
And there you are.
I'm professionally invisible.
There you go. So let's do a few minutes of silent contemplation to begin the evening, to center down. Thank you. Thank you. So tonight I'm going to talk about Plotinus, who was a late Greek philosopher, and I'm just going to touch. I'm going to talk a little bit about his biography, because his biography is very interesting. It's actually a lot about tells you a lot about him and his teaching and how it manifested in his life. You know, so it makes it less abstract, you know, like. And then I'm going to touch a little bit on a main teaching, and intermingling with this, I want to have a conversation. You know, so if there's questions that come up, please feel free, and we'll see where it goes. Okay, Plotinus, as I mentioned, was a Greek philosopher, but he was born in Egypt. In a city called Lycopolis, which was near Alexandria, and he lived from 205 to 270, a time of tremendous religious and spiritual and philosophical mingling of different traditions, specifically Judaism, Christianity, Stoicism, Platonism, and various other traditions. It's hard for us to understand, and this is one thing I really want to communicate, that philosophy at that time was not a matter of just analyzing arguments. It was considered to be a way of life. And for example, the school that Plotinus set up in Rome was very much like what we would call an ashram, much closer to that than what than say a philosophy department, and that dimension of philosophy is a way of life that had specific practices along with the reading, and that's been lost in the West, So, in fact, if you go to a philosophy department at a university today and you ask for that dimension, they'll look at you like you're crazy. They're completely uninterested in that. But it's important. For example, Justin Martyr, who is an early Christian writer, referred to Christianity as our philosophy. Isn't that interesting? And people spoke of converting to Stoicism, converting to Platonism. They would use those kinds of terms. So that's the place that philosophy held in the late Roman period. So it's good to keep that in mind. Plotinus studied in Alexandria, and he had been he had visited quite a number of teachers. Alexandria was full of them, from all over the world, including from India, which I'll bring in.
I'm not clear on what you're saying is alien in philosophy departments today. Was it inquiries?
What's alien, for example, Plotinus was a vegetarian.
Was a
vegetarian.
Okay.
And that was, part of studying in his school is that you would take on that commitment to be a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So if you went to a philosophy department today and you said, and what diet should I follow in order to study philosophy in this department, they look at you and go, who the F cares? Which one? It just wouldn't enter into the discussion. So that's an example of what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
A friend of Plotinus's suggested that he visit a teacher by the name of Ammonius Saccas, S-A-C-C-A-S, And he visited him, and it clicked that this is who I've been seeking. Ammonius Saccas has had a huge influence on Western history in his school, where Christians, Jews, pagans, you know, like, and but he never wrote anything. You know, Ammonius Saccas never wrote anything, but he had very famous students, Plotinus, Origen, people like that. So he had this huge influence, but we don't really know the specifics of what he was offering his community. When he stayed with his teacher for 11 years, and then Ammonius passed away. And now this is a very interesting episode in the life of Plotinus. He decided that what he wanted to do was to go to India to study with Indian sages after Ammonius died. And what that means is that there were Indian sages in Alexandria, you know, teaching. It's not clear to us exactly, you know, like, where, it's likely they were teaching the Upanishads, but we're not sure, you know, like, or what, you know, what specific tradition was present in Alexandria. As far as we know, there were no translations into Greek, although there could have been, but we don't have any remnants. But they must have impressed Plotinus a great deal, because he set upon this path to make a considerable journey to India, because after his teacher died, that's the tradition he wanted to connect with. And so he hooked up with an expedition by the Emperor Gordian, the Emperor of Rome. This is the same Gordian as the Gordian knot, so he joined because Emperor Gordian was going to the east and trying to reconquer various territories that had been whittled away from Rome, and Gordian was defeated at a great battle and killed, in that battle. In fact, his army was decimated, and the biography by Plotinus' students said that Plotinus made it back to Rome with difficulty. we don't have the details, but we can only imagine. He must have had some connections in Rome, though, because that's where, he didn't return to Alexandria. So we don't know the exact details of that. But
did he ever make it to India?
He never made it to India. Never made it. And he settled in Rome and set up a school, an ashram. And when I say ashram, I really think physically it was very much like an ashram. It was like a large house, which was given to him by one of his students. He was a very successful teacher. People from all ranks of life wanted to study with him. They found him to be a very congenial personality. And people would come to him with their, personal problems. We know that they did that, but we don't have stories about specifics, except for one thing. There were many children in Plotinus' school, and they were orphans of people who, when they realized that they were terminally ill, probably a plague or some, illness that swept through Rome in those days, they would leave their children with Plotinus to raise, and whatever resources they had, they would give to Plotinus to keep. And he was very diligent about those duties. So here you have, get this picture, he's giving talks about philosophy, the nature of the soul, the nature of the cosmos, and there are all these kids running around, he made sure that they were educated, that they got a job, that he placed them, all they, And he husbanded the resources so that when they achieved adulthood, all of that material was, you know, like turned over to them. Don't you think that's interesting? I just don't see that, you know, in a traditional vision of a philosophy teacher. It's that's not the kind of atmosphere, the situation I see. You know, and I think it's very refreshing. You know, like it means that he had, you know, 2 feet planted on the ground. You know, like as he was also having these very exalted discussions about philosophical and spiritual matters. You know, like the students he had were from many traditions. In this way, he imitated his teacher Ammonius. You know, like the reason we know that is because in the essays we have that he left behind, he is addressing specific traditions and specific issues raised by various groups at that time. And the view of most scholars is that that view was present in the community, and he was giving his understanding of where he agreed with it or where he didn't agree with it. You know, like, so there was a lot of intermingling going on in that period. He seems to have followed in his teacher's footsteps in that he didn't write anything until he was 50 years old. You know, like, and he began writing at the urging of his students, you know, like, because they requested that, he did start writing down his thoughts on various topics. The topics were usually the ones that concerned his students, you know, like the, in other words, he didn't have like a systematic outline, you know, like, the essays were collected by his students, and copies were made, and there seems to have been a lot of juggling for access to these to the copies of these teachings, you know, like.
Did he have women and men students?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He became ill when he, maybe in the last 2 years of his life. He always he had digestive problems, according to biographies of Plotinus, and they got quite severe. And he retired to a rural estate, which was owned by a doctor who was his student, but then became his caretaker. You know, like, he passed away at that rural estate. You know, like, and then after that. One of his principal students, who became a philosopher in his own right, a guy by the name of Porphyry, collected all of Plotinus's essays and arranged them into 6 groups of 9 essays each, for a total of 54. Because the groupings are 9 essays each, they're called enneads, which in which means the nines, you know, like, which seems like a kind of a foreign title for them. What Porphyry did is that he arranged them topically. So the last group, for example, is on the nature of the ultimate, the good, and the one. And the fifth group is on the nature of the soul. You know, like, and the first group is the it's about ethics and civic virtues, things like that. You know, like, fortunately for us, Porphyry, who was very diligent and left us a record of the chronological order in which they were written. You know, so we have both the topical arrangement and the chronological arrangement of the essays. So the range of the enneads is vast. And Plotinus was the inheritor of a tradition started by Plato, Plotinus is considered the founder of a tradition called Neoplatonism. That's retroactively given to him. He considered himself simply a spokesman for the Platonic tradition. Now, when Plotinus was teaching, the Platonic tradition was, I think, 700 years old. Is that right? Plato was about 500 BC. This is 200, so it's about 700 years old. And there was a vast corpus of commentaries and sub-commentaries and, that kind of thing. And that makes some of his essays difficult to read, because he's assuming that the audience has an acquaintance at a minimum with Plato's dialogues, and he also makes the assumption on more than one occasion that you're acquainted with the commentarial tradition. And most importantly, of course, would be Aristotle, there's a whole section, for example, where he critiques Aristotle's system of categories. He doesn't agree with Aristotle, but if you don't know what Aristotle's categories are, you're sort of kind of reading, going, well, all right, but why are you spending time on this? But at that time, it was a hot issue. Discussed, a great deal. What's interesting about reading, and I'm the first to say, Plotinus is a tough read. He's not easily accessible. Like most philosophers, he's a bad writer. Plato was an exception. Plato was a very, very good writer. And it's interesting to see the difference. When Plato wrote his dialogues, there was always a narrative. There's always a story. And there are characters. And the characters are interesting. Socrates is interesting, obviously. But all the other characters are very interesting. They have personalities, inclinations. He gives you a little bit about their background. And that's very helpful, when you're reading, to have this kind of storyline. Most philosophers don't do that. There's almost none of that in Plotinus, and that does create a barrier. But if you stick with it, Plotinus will be going along and he'll be doing his Greek thing, this follows from that, and therefore this, and therefore that, and then all of a sudden he'll go off on these ecstatic flights into ultimate nature, and it becomes poetic, this really sublime writing about this sphere of the oneness of all things, and how all things are imbued with soul, how the earth itself has a soul, how he was able to contact that dimension of reality, It's very interesting, to have these two kind of dimensions of discourse, woven together in the essays. I enjoy it, but I will say it takes some dedication to access it, which is why I recommend that people, if you're interested in Plotinus, I recommend that you start with an introductory volume. That you don't necessarily just go right to the Aeneid himself. I call the talk Return to the One because I think the best introduction to Plotinus is that book over there, Return to the One by Brian Hines. I think he does a really, really good job, and he has a way with words, for example, his chapter titles, God is the goal, one is overall, spirit is substance, all is alive, creation is contemplation. He loves alliteration, and he used it throughout the book. And the alliteration really, pulls you along. It's kind of snappy and very clever, So I highly recommend this particular one if you're interested in Plotinus. He has spent as much time, probably more on Plotinus as I have, And we're both in a similar situation. Like, I don't know Greek. Like, I have not read Plotinus in the original Greek. You know, like, and neither is Brian Hines. So he is, you know, like, so I give it two thumbs up for, you know, Return to the One as an excellent introduction. So, you know, the life of Plotinus to me is expressive of somebody who actually lived his insights. You know, we say he walked his talk, you know, like, and there's some descriptions about him where, you know, like, he's in this ecstatic state of union, and then some duty, you know, comes along, like he has to make sure that the kid gets to his tutor or, you know, like something like that, and he simply does it, right? Or and then when he's finished with his task, he goes right back to his contemplation. And Porphyry says it's as if the contemplation wasn't interrupted at all. You know, like, and it's a wonderful description, you know, like, of someone whose worldly duties did not create a hindrance for him, you know, like, to this union with the divine. It's really wonderful to read about that kind of thing, and there's an aspect about Plotinus which I also appreciate. In the Enneads, he describes his ascent to the One and to this union, and he's very humble about this. You know, like, he says that he's been able to have a feeling of complete union like 4 to 6 times in his life. You know, and there's lesser experiences. You know, like, so he doesn't brag, you know, like, about it. You know, like, but he does describe it, and it's very inspiring. You know, like, as an example of how to live, and that you can live that way. I find him very inspiring. So let's. A little bit about the influence of Plotinus. After Rome fell and the West, you know, entered into its period of tumult, you know, like, contact with Greek culture was lost, and Plotinus was lost to the West, you know, to the European culture. You know. They did know about him by name because Augustine had a very high opinion of Plotinus. You know, like, so, Augustine, I can't remember where Augustine says it, but he says the only thing missing from Plotinus is Jesus. You know, like, so, something like that. You know, like, but in the Byzantine Empire, which continued for another 1,000 years, they continued to read Plotinus, to comment on Plotinus. You know, like, this is what we would call Eastern Orthodoxy. You know, like, and Plotinus exerted a huge influence on that branch of Christianity. You know, like, and I feel like the West is just beginning to realize this kind of influence. I feel that in that region of the world, the Middle East, there's probably, you know, volumes of commentaries and emendations about Plotinus that we haven't even accessed, you know, yet. You know, like, but yeah, for European culture in the 1400s, a man by the name of Marsilio Ficino translated after the fall of the Byzantine Empire, there was a wave of Greek scholars who came into European culture, and Ficino learned Greek, and he translated the Enneads into Latin. All right, and this was one of the primary reasons for the emergence of the Renaissance and the injection of Neoplatonic ideas into the West. All right, and Plotinus continues to exert a strong influence, but for example, William Butler Yeats was a huge fan of Plotinus, and you can see it in his poetry. You know, like he uses a lot of terms. You know, like so that's just a. I'm told by some of my Jewish friends that in Jewish mysticism, the Zohar is heavily influenced by Plotinus. But I tried reading the Zohar once, and I just went like just completely past me. You know, like, but I believe them. I mean, and in Islamic culture, Plotinus had a huge influence on Sufism. Like, and Plotinus was translated into Arabic fairly early. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact dates. So he continues to have this this influence. And it's because he was a mystic, like, and so this mystical understanding, that seed gets planted, you know, wherever the field is nourishing, you know, for that kind of realization. So let's talk a little bit about Plotinus' teachings. You know, like, so, so imagine three. Concentric circles. That's all right. So that's how you're supposed to imagine it. So the circle at the center, you know, like the inmost center, is the ineffable. You know, like, and Plotinus specifically says that it is beyond being. You know, like, it is not. It is not being. It is beyond being. It is before being. It is before name. It is before form. Strictly speaking, nothing can be said about it. It is that from which all things emerge. It is the great creator of all things. You know, like, and there it is at the center. You know, like, it is the ultimate to. It is the ultimate destination of our spiritual journey, you know, like that. And then the next circle, the Greek word is nous, N-O-U-S, you know, like, which is often translated as intellect, but it's also translated as spirit, you know, which gives you the idea of how difficult it is to translate this Greek word, you know, like, this first circle out from the center. Is the reason it's called intellect because that's where the first thing that can be said about the nameless is said. Okay, so, you know, like, and the way Plotinus describes this is that it is next to this nameless and formless. It is next to it. I love this kind of analysis because Plotinus is trying to show that talking about the ultimate, it's okay as long as you know where you're standing. You know, like, but it's not the ultimate itself. It's next to it. It's standing next to it, but it's not of it.
The way I remember that is potential and actuality.
Right, right. That's one of the ways he expresses it. Yeah. And
so, say that again.
So why was
potentiality and actuality?
So why was the first circle beyond the ineffable intellect rather than emotion or feeling or just raw sensation?
From Plotinus's perspective, that would be a later emanation. And that's because he was a good Platonist. You know, like, but I'll give an example later on about why this makes sense. Okay, so I mean, right now it's very abstract, but I will be giving examples of why this particular perspective is coherent. And remember, this is a spiritual cosmology. It's not a physical cosmology. Right? It isn't like you're going to go off into space and find this, you know, black hole that's the ineffable, or something like that. You know, like he's creating a map of the spiritual journey. That's the function of it. you know, like, and that map is next to the ultimate. So it's important to keep that in mind, that he's not confusing, he's not saying this is the objective reality. You know, like, his purpose in giving us this description is to give us a guide for the spiritual journey that we can use. You know, like, and then the third circle is the realm of soul. Right? So, and individuation comes in, you know, like, and so there are, Plotinus' view was that because everything in existence was an emanation from the ineffable, everything possessed soul. Like, so, and so he believed, for, there's a whole section in one of the Enneads about the soul of the earth, for example. So the earth is embodied and filled with earth, you know, like, and so what is soul in a human being? The soul in a human being is the presence of the ineffable one in the ephemeral individual. You know, like, it is an emanation, the presence of an emanation from this central circle. You know, like, and when we turn to that, then we can return to that one. You know, like, so, is this confusing?
What do you mean by return to it? When we go. When we die?
His view, no, you can do it while you're alive.
Oh,
it's usually the mystic.
It's the mystic union. The mystic union with the ultimate is what he's referring to. Right, so. So, here we are. We have this, this ultimate ineffable, and then we have the second ring, you know, this spirit or intellect. And there are three names that Plotinus would use to describe, you know, in this second ring, which were his favorites. And they were the one, the good, and the beautiful. You know, like, those were his three that he would really lean on. You know, like, as he, in one of the Enneads in the sixth collection, he talks about how, strictly speaking, you can't say anything about it. But because he wants to communicate with people, he's going to use these terms, you know, like the good. So, it's interesting. I actually think that Plotinus's vision is very close to Taoism, but. I know, it's like, so, this is Greek philosophy, this is Taoism. Like, so, but, so you have, in section one of the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu has a very similar teaching about ultimate nature, which he calls the Tao. You know, like, so the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the beginning of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of the 10,000 things. Ever desireless, one can see the mystery. Ever desiring, one can see the manifestations. These two spring from the same source, but differ in name. This appears as darkness, darkness within darkness, the gate to all mystery. So, the ultimate nature is a darkness in the sense that it is beyond the light of reason, right? Which incidentally is a very un-Greek notion. I'm not sure Plato would have approved at all, like this, but so, there's a very, very similar understanding here, that at the core of our existence there is this nameless, formless presence which all things emerge from, you know, all things lean on. You know, I love this kind of connection. You know, so I add a name in my second circle. I add something that Plotinus rarely uses. He does use it one or two times, but it's pretty rare. And the name I give to this nameless and firmless is the eternal. It is that which is eternal. Right? It is that which never does not exist. It's the always existing. Or as the Buddha would say, it is the deathless and unborn. You know, like, so in the Itivataka, the Buddha says, there is that which is deathless, unborn, unconditioned. Like, if there were not the deathless, the unborn, and the unconditioned, liberation would not be possible. But because there is the deathless, the unborn, and the unconditioned, liberation is possible. Thus I say. Itivataka means thus I say. Like, so. It's a similar realization, you know, like there, that there is this deathless, unborn realm. So, questions or comments?
You were saying earlier about potentiality, or what was mentioned?
Actuality, potentiality.
Right. Were those the first two circles?
Well, you could name the ultimate as the potential for all existing things. And actuality would actually be the third.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the way I remember it is that the absolute has this potential, is in the center of the circle. And then there's a circle around that. And that's close quarters. That's the actuality of the ineffable one that's kind of present for humanity. But that's a closed system. I mean, that's Godhead. And then the other circle is outside, and that's our soul. And then there's a light that goes from the center of the absolute through the second person. From a Christian point of view, it would be like the second person of the Trinity. And then flowing out to the center of our soul, which is the other circles you were talking about, which is our soul, which is in the, like you said, a manifestation or
emanation
of the divine.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I think that's where they got some of the ideas of the Trinity.
Yeah. Thank you. So So what's he talking about here? You know, like I want to give some concrete examples about why this makes sense. Okay, you know, like so. From suppose you want to throw a party for some friends. So, where does that idea come from? Seriously, where does that idea come from? Because my teacher Sansanin used to say, "Don't know." if you try it, trace it back, you know, don't know, you know, where did this idea come from? I mean, you can come up with all sorts of explanations, and all of them are probably true, but ultimately, you know, like, you really don't know. It's like there's certain types of Buddhist meditation you can get into which slow down the mind, and you can actually see an idea emerge like a bubble in water, you know, coming up, you know, like from very deep. You can actually see the idea float up and gradually take shape and take form, but there's still, you know, like beyond that perception when it first appears, you know, like it's, you know, like so there you have, everything arises out of that ineffability, and then it appears as an idea, you know, which is like the second circle. Your life, right? And then you take that idea and you go and you create a list, you know, like, well, I got to get the food, I got to get the, like, I got to call the people, you know, like that. And then it becomes a manifestation, you know, like. And if you look at things that way, you know, like, you can see I find it very helpful to look at things that way. It makes Plotinus's cosmological, like, I get what he's talking about. Because you see, in the Platonic tradition, the world of sense perception is less real than the world of ideas, which is less real than the world of nous, whether that's spirit or intellect it's a very difficult word, and not knowing Greek, I can't enter into discussions about it, but I can tell you from reading several translations that the scholars don't agree either, and the most real is the ineffable and the nameless. So it's hard for us to see it, particularly at this cultural moment. There's a very strong belief that only that which is sensorily observable is real, But the Platonic tradition had reversed that. The experience of they didn't say it was unreal. They call it the great chain of being, And so, at the level of sensory reality, that is the least real. Why? Because it's all impermanent. So if you use the scimitar of the eternal, you can discriminate here, very clearly. So everything we see is vanishing away. Everything we see, everything we hear, everything we touch, everything we taste, everything we think about, everything we feel, all of it is passing away. So, I wrote a poem about it. I'll share with you.
Hooray!
So, the poem is called Corrective Lenses. views, constructs, perspectives, commentaries, interpretations. We do not see the world. What we see is our own mind. We see everything through glasses that distort all the things that we find, as if orange was the color of glasses. Like those who believe that nothing surpasses their desires that crumble like broken fences. As if a solid mountain range contained passes. As if truth was determined by vote of the masses. Or those who believe that the only thing we can grasp is that which can be measured and observed by the five senses. Unconcerned and unaware that all these things become ashes. But all becomes clear when we think of this. Everything vanishes. Everything vanishes except the one. So my teacher Santanini used to say, There is one thing which is pure and clear. It is pure and clear. It is not dependent upon life or death. Right? What is the one pure and clear thing? See, then he'd have his stick that he'd hit you if you didn't have a good answer. he'd be sued today. He'd be sued.
That sounds an awful lot like dependent origination.
Yeah, except it is and it isn't.
What was that word?
Dependent origination, which is a Buddhist concept for the causal matrix of existence. So, dependent origination, the Buddha summed it up as this exists, therefore that exists. This does not exist, therefore that does not exist. That kind of teaching, so given any specific thing, it arises dependent upon causes and conditions, and then Buddhism concludes, and this is where Plotinus and Buddhism probably differ. Buddhism therefore concludes that everything is empty of ultimate nature, but Plotinus does not draw that conclusion. His view is that there must be one thing which is pure and clear, you know, nameless form of, which gives unity to the specific things that exist. Without that one thing, things would not, in fact, be things. You know, like, it's his view. Now, I'm not arguing for it or against it. I'm just saying that there's kind of a difference, you know, like, between
in
the two.
Sense, but it's also true that they would say that emptiness is in everything.
Right, I understand.
So that's not all that different.
Right.
Right.
Point taken. You score! Marshall?
We're talking about mystical union, and he sounds a lot like Calvin in his tradition of how he saw the faith works paradox in the Reformation. And I'm wondering what effect he may have had on Calvin.
I have no idea. I have no idea. Follow that out. Make that connection. So.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I mean, you said the second circle, you had the Greek word for it, nous. Is there a Greek word for the first circle and the third circle?
Yeah, there is. I can't remember.
They don't necessarily.
They're not as problematic. So I didn't, you know, like, when I read different translators, it isn't like, wow, you know, like, you guys aren't agreeing at all, you know, like, on this. So it didn't register. I'm sorry. So apologies for that. You know,
it's like, so interesting how so many philosophies and thought processes are in threes, right? You
know, yes, isn't that?
I mean, I keep thinking of the Holy Trinity.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like, threes.
And so here we have this cosmology, right? Now, what is the function of that kind of cosmology, that kind of picture? Well, I indicated before, he's drawing a kind of a map to help us on our spiritual journey. So there is within us a light, and he does call it a light, you know, like an inner light, which is an emanation from this one. And Plotinus's view is that what we need to do is turn to that inner light and follow it back to the source. You know, like, I like to call this tracing back the radiance. You know, tracing back the radiance to the source. You know, like, so how do we do that? One second. For Plotinus's view is that it's a matter of shifting our attention away from the ephemeral to that which always exists. You know, like, so. But since it's nameless and formless, you know, like, how do you pay attention to that which has no name and which has no form? So the basic idea is to, on a regular basis, enter into contemplation, and in that contemplation you put aside all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, everything which arises, and you let it settle, and then that inner light will manifest. You know, like, that it sounds very simple, but it takes some dedication and some practice to do that. Yes, Will.
That's the absolute essence of Orthodox mysticism.
Yeah.
And that they would just call that light the Holy Spirit.
Right.
And it is important to point out, I'm not saying Plotinus was a Christian, but it's proven that Ammodius Saccas' parents were Christians.
Uh-huh.
And there's much debate as to whether Ammodius Saccas.
Right.
Some scholars say Ammodius Saccas was a Christian.
Right.
And some say that he wasn't, but it's no doubt that his parents were.
Yeah.
So there's a huge Christian influence that was passing through. So he obviously, and plus you yourself said that Origen,
right,
you know, who is the father of Christian theology, studied under Ammodius Saccas. So it's no doubt that the descriptions that he's talking about are strongly associated with the Trinity.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
In fact, it's highly likely that that is actually where they got the concept of the Trinity is from, that very book, The Ennead.
I want you to follow that. I want to read the essay that establishes that. I would be very excited to read that. Please, you know, like, I'm going to bug you to know about it.
Okay.
See, it's this period, the late Roman period, was this marvelous period of cross-fertilization. You know, like, I mean, one of the reasons I find Plotinus so inspiring is, and his teacher, Ammonius Sockles, you know, like, is his spaciousness and his openness to being influenced, you know, like to accepting all of these points of view without rancor, or, you know, they had discussions in his schools. It isn't that, you know, like, he could be critical, you know, like, for example, there's a wonderful essay in his one of the Enneads is called Against the Gnostics. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? You know, like, it's a critique of Gnosticism. Gnosticism today is almost a synonym for mysticism, you know, like the way people use the word Gnostic today. But at the time that Plotinus was writing, there were specific groups that considered themselves to be Gnostics. And what Plotinus was criticizing was that their rigid dualism, you know, like, that sensory, that creation was evil. That was their point of view. You know, mm-hmm. Creation was evil. The body was evil, and you had to, you know, like, somehow, you know, like, if you, by doing the right things, you could get out. You know, like, but Plotinus had a, and that's who he was criticizing. You know, like, you know, in his essay Against the Gnostics. You know, like, so he was capable of being, you know, like, entering into discussions with various groups, but in one modern commentary on that essay, it says there were probably Gnostics in his community. Otherwise, why would he have written the essay? You know, like, so he had them there, and then he interacted with them. He says, "This is how I view. This is how I understand it. I don't share your view." You know, like, about this. There's a wonderful balance in Plotinus, which at times you'll read him and he has a very strong ascetic streak, like you need to turn away from sensory experiences in order to return to the one. Right? But then he also, in his Ennead on Beauty, he describes how the beauty of existence is a doorway to the ultimate. Things are beautiful because they are emanations of the one. You know, like, that's where beauty comes from. So beauty is the signal to us of the presence of the ultimate. You know, like, so that's why nature can be inspiring in this uplifting way. You know, like, and in his Ennead on Beauty, he talks about in the same section, he talks about the beauty of a beautiful house and the beauty of a stone as both embodying, or as embodying that beauty which comes from the one. So, like, so the three names he would use were the one, the beautiful,
the good.
So anytime we do anything good, it's a signal, it's a sign of the presence of that ultimacy within us. You know, like, anytime you see something beautiful, in other words, sensory existence is telling us all the time that there is this surpassing dimension of existence. You know, like, it's letting us know all the time, but we can't hear it. You know, like, so how do you hear it? You settle the wandering imagination of your mind, and you sit in silence, and you enter into this contemplative dimension of existence, and then you can access it.
Did they do it in a group way, or this was an individual practice?
You know, that's a very good question. It's one of the frustrating things about philosophy from that period, and the Enneads is no exception, is there's no section in the Enneads on method. And so scholars talk about that, and from what I've gleaned is that the method was given orally. You know, like, it wasn't meant to be written down. You know, like, there's a comparison I make from Zen history about this. In early Zen history in China, where it was known as Chan, there are no manuals of Zen meditation. None. You know, like, the word Zen means meditation, you know, like, but there's no written instruction about Zen meditation until about 1000, you know, maybe 1100. You know, like, then all of a sudden you find manuals of Zen meditation. So some Western scholars have suggested that means that they weren't meditating, like, because there's no manual, so if there's no text, you know, like, then you know, like, a scholar is likely to say, well, you know, like, then it didn't happen. But my interpretation of that is there's also no manual about how to cook rice, mm-hmm. you know, like, in Zen monasteries. You know, like, but that doesn't mean that they weren't cooking rice or millet or whatever it was. You know, like, and the, it wasn't necessary to write down these instructions because, one, they were simple. You know, like, two, they so permeated the community that everyone shared this understanding. You know, like, so it wasn't an issue. It isn't like people were arguing about whether or not they should meditate. In a similar sort of way, I view contemplation in the Platonic and also the Neoplatonic tradition was so much a part of what they were doing that it wasn't... there wasn't any compelling reason to, you know, create a manual of meditation. There's a French scholar by the name of Pierre Hadot. I can't remember, he died maybe 15 or 20 years ago. But he was a scholar of late Roman philosophy. And I think I have one of his books over there, Philosophy as a Way of Life. And another book he wrote is called What is Ancient Philosophy? You know, like, he translated the Enneads into French, you know, like, and wrote commentary on it as well. And that's his view, is that what we are reading is what they would discuss in, say, open lectures, you know, like, for anyone could drop in and drop by, and they would have these discussions. But for the students who were close to the teacher, you know, like, there would be these contemplations. And we know that there were certain practices that Plotinus required of his community. I mentioned vegetarianism. You know, like, there were others. You know, like, for example, Plotinus refused to take any kind of medication that was derived from animal sources. You know, like, even if it would benefit him. Like, they also, the belief in reincarnation was central to the Plotinian worldview. It is a central teaching of Platonism. It's something I remember when I first encountered this in college, you know, like, and I wanted to know more about it. You cannot get a Western philosophy department today to discuss to discuss reincarnation and its importance in the Platonic tradition. You can't do it. They will not do it. You know, like, and but Plotinus's view of the spiritual journey is that it took place over many, many lifetimes. You know, it was a long journey. Mm. You know, like, and he believed that ascent over lifetimes was not inevitable, that you could fall, you know, into a lower state, you know, like, depending on your what you had done in your life. So he had a conception of karma, although he doesn't use that word. You know, like, there's a you get that feeling, you know, like, so that dimension of the spiritual traditions of that time is lost. So we know from like reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations that there were certain beginning practices that Stoics undertook, and one of them was to carefully distinguish what is in my control and what is not in my control, right? And to cease to worry about what is not in my control. The idea was to develop, in the Stoic tradition, you developed apatheia, from which our word apathy comes from. But it apatheia is not the same as apathy. It's like the tendency is for human beings to get agitated over everything they dislike that they hear about, whether or not they can actually enter into it or have a say about it. And what the Stoics, a beginning practice, and this is all through Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, he's making this distinction over and over and over again. Here he is, the emperor of the Roman Empire at its greatest extent geographically, one of the most powerful people on earth, maybe the most powerful person on earth. And he writes in his Meditations, goes, someone flatters me. Well, there he is at court. You can imagine, surrounded. Says, what is that to me? Someone flatters me. What is that to me? Does it make me a better person? Does it make me a worse person? Someone is angry with me. What is that to me? Does that make me a better person? Does that make me a worse person? So what he's doing, what Haddad points out is that Marcus Aurelius must have had a Stoic teacher who was saying to him, you need to keep this journal, and record your progress in making this kind of distinction. And it's one of the things which made him a very effective ruler, that he was able to make those distinctions. So in the Platonic school, what were the beginning practices? What were the middle practices? What was the truth is we don't know. We have a general idea. But I'd like to add, it is a loss. We really would like to know what they were doing. Were they sitting in Zazen? Were they doing Vipassana? We'd really like to know the details, but there's an interesting effect from the fact that what we have of Plotinus does not contain a method, a specific method. And that is because he didn't have a method, he was able to influence various traditions. If he had had a method in the Aeneid, that would have made his tradition the Plotinian tradition. Because the method doesn't survive in the work itself, the method part is filled by the various traditions from their background. Am I making sense here? And that continues to be the case.
Jim, but your description of that settling thing is very much like Vipassana.
Yeah, it is. I got that. Yeah.
Interesting. At least a powerful correlation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But what we don't know is, for example, when Plotinus has these general descriptions, but we don't have an actual, what I would call, manual of how, students, did they sit in a chair? Did they sit on the floor? Did they do walking meditation? Did they, all that kind of information is simply not there anymore.
So was that a trade secret in modern vernacular?
It could have been a trade secret. There's some scholars who believe that it was esoteric and that there was an initiatic element in these traditions. I'm skeptical about that. I lean more toward my explanation about why there's no manual of meditation in the Zen tradition until 1000. You see, in 1000, the Chan tradition split in two, and you had one group that went off and began doing koan introspection, which is those questions that Zen masters like to ask, like, you know, does a dog have Buddha nature? You know, and then you would contemplate that. And another branch of Zen went off and stayed with silent introspection. You know, like, and because then you had two different branches, the need for the meditation manuals arose. In other words, so the teacher said, I'm not doing koan introspection. What I'm doing is this, you know, or the koan introspection teacher would say, no, 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 we're not getting lost in silent wandering in the mind. Like, we're doing, you know, like we're doing this, you know, like, so the need arose, and then after that you have lots of manuals of Zen meditation, right down to the present day, you know, like, so, because there was a distinction, but before there was a distinction, you didn't have the need. And in the Platonic tradition, evidently that need never arose. It was simply understood. Or in the Stoic tradition, there's no, the closest you get is Epictetus's Enchiridion, you know, like, and, but even there, it's not really what we would call a manual of meditation. You know, so the instructions were oral, you know, like, my guess is that they were simple, and they were broadly understood.
Back in the time of the Greek mysteries, when Plato was around, he had the initiates, and they were—they would be executed if they revealed yep. their initiation practice.
That is true. And the Eleusinian mysteries, if you revealed the mysteries, it was a capital offense. You know, like. And it was evidently quite effective because we don't really know what they were teaching. Anybody who says they reconstructed the Eleusinian mysteries, I'd be very skeptical, you know, like, so, about that. You know, like, so that's a good point. So, but to return to Plotinus. So. I have found over the decades Plotinus to be a very inspiring guide, both in terms of the life he lived, you know, like, and in terms of someone I can lean on as a source for inspiration, you know, like, and I mean, this is partly my personality. I like to read philosophical material. I like to read that kind of material. And I really like the interweaving he does between this sort of cerebral Greek approach and this ecstatic, you know, leap into the divine. I find it very refreshing and very inspiring that even someone with an analytical mind can make it. For those of us who aren't very intuitive, it's, you know, it's nice to have that model going. And so I offer you, you know, like, the thought of Plotinus and his approach, his cosmology. I just touched on a few items this evening. You know, like, this isn't, you know, it's not a seminar on Plotinus or something like that. And if you feel so inclined, you know, like, I would suggest, you know, Return to the One, you know, like, as a very accessible, kind of cheerful romp through the thought of Plotinus, you know, like, and of course, for those who are so inclined, there's always the essays themselves, you know, like, my feeling is that Plotinus will continue to be a benign influence on the world, you know, like, and that's one of the things I really, I don't know, it's amazing to me is that his influence on the world has been entirely benign. You know, like, it's not, you know, like, he hasn't generated that, you know, that angry, vindictive side that so many religions and philosophies and ideologies seem to generate. Mm. You know, like, his people who have read him, like Ficino, for example, you know, like, or the Eastern Orthodox scholars, and have benefited hugely, you know, like, and been inspired to a greater sense of union and unity with all life and all people, you know, like, and that's a wonderful legacy, you know, like, so. Are there any closing questions or thoughts that people want to share?
You said he was 70, right? Lived to be 70.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would that have been very unusual for somebody to live that long in their
country? That's an interesting question. I don't think it. In his biographies, it's not remarked upon. I actually don't know what the demographics were at the time.
Yeah.
You know, like.
It just seems like maybe, you know, because he lived to be a ripe old age. Mm-hmm. That his philosophy was able to develop.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. Yeah. So he was able to guide people over an extended period of time. You know, like, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, I just find myself being baffled and happy that the early Christians were able to be open to him, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Could you help set it in context? This was before the Nicene Creed and everything got kind of codified, right? So the Christians were really just like trying to figure out a philosophy at this time?
Well, there are scholars of early Christianity who whose view is that Christianity is the religious dimension of Platonism. You know, like, and that was injected into Christian thought through Plotinus. You know, like, so, in a way, you know, Jesus was a Jew. You know, like, and Jewish thought and Greek thought. I mean, there are similarities, but there are also some striking differences. You know, like, between the two as well. You know, like, but I think that. Plotinus's point of view provided a vehicle for describing the ascent to God, you know, and Plotinus does use the word God at times, you know, to as a name for the One, you know, like in a way that was very congenial, you know, like to both the Hebrew scriptures and the Greek scriptures, you know, like so. They found them very compatible, which at first seems kind of a challenge, you know. Like, but there was at that time this openness and this willingness to enter into those kinds of discussions and to weave them together. The only other time in another time in history that I know. It replicates that kind of interweaving is Tang Dynasty China, you know, like where you had Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism, and they were mutually influencing each other and exchanging vocabulary and exchanging practices and generating a lot of. They mutually nourished each other without abolishing each other. And that's a wonderful achievement, you know, like to be that spacious. So, am I responding to your question, or did I lose sight of it? Okay, thank you.
Some people claim that the end of the 20th century was a similar time.
Ah, when, look back
when,
on that.
When translations of Eastern religions and when the Christians adapted. And they lost their sense of contemplation. They ended up going back to Zen centers to learn
right.
it. And there was a lot of cross-fertilization happening in the last half of the 20th century.
The contemplative dimension, to me, is the heart of any genuine spiritual tradition. You know, like so. So it is that light within, and it is. I like to say the light within is the presence of eternity in the ephemeral individual. Mm-hmm. You're like, and when you experience that light, it is transformative of how you see things, how you see yourself, how you see your place and your journey. You know, like, So, so may we all awaken to that presence. Thank you. You're welcome.
Good start.
Yeah.
May you all awaken to the presence of the donation bowl over there. And share with our speakers the contents thereof, and also retain, have to maintain this space. And of course, do check out the books over there. And thank you so much for coming out tonight on this chilly evening and first evening of 2017. Thank you.